Welcome to Dr. Ralph Presents William Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew. This lecture, delivered by American Shakespeare Center Director of Mission and Mary Baldwin College Shakespeare Professor Dr. Ralph Allen Cohen, was recorded in front of a live audience at the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia, on September 22nd, 2010.
Okay, so tonight's topic is Taming of the Shrew. How many are here for the first time? Who's here for the first time? So this is the first time you've been in it. Have you ever seen it? Is this that first time you walked in the room? It's just pretty nice, isn't it? It's beautiful, isn't it? But you guys are going to see tonight in a space that is carefully recreated as far as we know. As far as you can recreate something no one knows what it looked like, it's carefully recreated, like the Globe in London. And using some of the same scholars' advice, we built this. And the main thing about this space is that this is exactly the kind of space that Shakespeare would have had in mind after 1597, because he was thinking about the Blackfriars. Couldn't move in until 1608, but he was thinking about spaces like this. And in the most important respects, this space does imitate the Globe. And the most important respect is that the thrust is out here. And this is all going to have a lot to do with what I have to say about Shrew. And what your experience tonight is going to be. We care a lot here about Shakespeare's stagecraft. We look at the text a whole lot. This is the set. It will not change. It cannot change, just like Shakespeare's couldn't change. And the lights that you're in right now are exactly the light you'll be in later, and it will not change, and our actors will see you, and they will talk to you. And I will try to make a connection between that little introduction to the space and the play you're going to see tonight, which is a very important play in my own personal history. Because I'm an English professor, my PhD is in English Renaissance. I actually wrote my doctorate on Ben Jonson's works. He was a contemporary of Shakespeare, and not on Shakespeare. Though I love Shakespeare so much, I tried to write my dissertation on Shakespeare. I actually tried. I had a topic and everything, and I sat down in my carrel, and I would look at one line, and anybody here who's ever studied Shakespeare will know this is true, and that line would would make me think of so many things. There were so many things to say that I was pacing around I jump up. I couldn't sit still. I'm not a very calm person anyway, and I would jump up all the time. I couldn't focus because my brain would seem like it had too many things happening in it. And I look back, finally getting kind of desperate for what was I going to do for my dissertation. I look back on a paper I had written for a Renaissance drama course on Ben Jonson's use of London in his plays, and it had gotten a very high grade, and so I thought, well, you know, I like Ben Jonson, but he doesn't make me jump out of my chair. So that's what I'll do. I'll study some Ben Jonson. So I became a professor of Shakespeare, like most professors of Shakespeare, in 1973 when I finished up. I was interested. I had been trained in new criticism. I was all about the plays as poetry and as writing. I was not interested much in the theater. This is before the postmodern movement, so I wasn't interested much in theory. And then I got involved, started a studies abroad program, and started seeing a lot of plays in London, starting in 75. I got to see all of the most famous plays that RSC put on. I saw all the most famous productions. I just was getting ready to do you a lecture on Wild Oats, which I needed to prepare, since we don't normally do this. I don't need to prepare a Taming the Shrew lecture. And I just finishing that, and I called up here at the box office and said, can I send it down to your printer, because our printer isn't working. And Michael said, what? And I said, a lecture on Wild Oats. He says, you're talking on Shrew tonight. I said, oh, okay. I sent it anyway. But I saw that Wild Oats. When I was putting this together, I saw pictures of the Wild Oats. It's so famous, the one in 76 when they rediscovered the play, which has, we're not going to hear about Wild Oats. But anyhow, I saw that production. It's very famous. I saw everything they did. And I got by 1983, when the story I'm about to start with about Shrew took place, I got where I thought I had something to say about staging. And I had a large Shakespeare class, and I had very, very good actors in the class, because I would not let the English department require Shakespeare, because I wanted to make sure that all the majors who were there because they wanted to be. But the theater department required that their students be there. So I had a lot of theater kids. And one of them was a fine actress, and I had to teach Taming of the Shrew. Now, let me say that I had never taught Taming of the Shrew this would have been 1980, 81 or something like that. The reason I hadn't taught it was pretty simple. It is that it wasn't in the curriculum, because we only had one Shakespeare course. And so I did some comedies, but you wouldn't throw Shrew in with things as great as You Like It, Much Ado, Midsummer Night's Dream. It just doesn't weigh enough. You just wouldn't do it. And besides that, I had three daughters, and I wasn't into wanting to teach a play with a title that ugly. I just, even back then, I didn't want to do that. But the course got very popular, and so what we did was we had to do two semesters. Now I was doing a course in the comedies, and when you do a course in the comedies and you do a play every week or week and a half, you're going to have to include Shrew. So there I was, dealing with this play, which is, on many levels, most disturbing. And I especially feel the father of daughters and no sons, and I didn't know how to handle it. But I was bewildered, because I really know my Shakespeare. I knew it then. I knew my stuff. And I know all of his other comedies. And I know that in all the other comedies, the women are much smarter than the men. And the wisdom of the play is that men should damn well listen to women. In fact, it's not going too far to say the tragedies are the ones where the guys are in charge, and the comedies are the ones where the females are in charge. It's really not, and when the females get in trouble, it's because they want to be like guys, like Lady Macbeth, or like Portia in Julius Caesar, who stabs herself in the thigh at one point and later on swallows fire. I mean, that's imitating the guys, The women are usually like Beatrice or Rosalind or, they're wise, Portia and Merchant of Venice. So they're wise and good, and the guys look like fraternity boys around them, and which is, Shakespeare plays a lot with that idea. So, regardless of anything anyone else can say about this play's politics, everybody has to say, no matter how much they don't like the play, that it seems to be an exception in regards to women. Okay? I'll start there. Now, let me say that I have gotten into great trouble already with this play, because I'm a guy. And for me to come in and tell people that actually much in this play interrogates the sexism that we see, the unpleasantness, much of it does, and that Petruchio could actually be a liberation figure trying to help out in a society that wasn't going to change, but at least give a solution to how to be happy. If I say that, it sounds to women like my Jewish ears would hear a German explaining to me why some play why Wagner's really fine on Jews. I'm sure it sounds like that to them, because I keep offending my female colleagues in Shakespeare by trying to say even the least little thing good about this play. I get in trouble, even though many of them have said good things. So I'm sort of trapped here tonight with you, wanting to say that I actually find some things in this play intriguing, and knowing that it's being podcast, and that my place in the academic firmament will get lower if I talk too openly of the ways in which I find Petruchio a little bit like Katharine Hepburn in Bringing Up Baby, which is acting crazy to win someone. And that's, to me, that's exactly what he's thought of. I've never used that analogy before. That's pretty good. So I have a thought about how to deal with this play and to talk to you about it, because it is uncomfortable for me still. There are unpleasant things in the play. The play ends with a speech that's right out of St. Paul. It's the most harsh kind of Pauline idea of what marriage should be like. The husband is the head, the woman is the foot. Bang, bang. I mean, just really tough stuff to read and to hear. And he does also say other things in the course of the play that I would argue always when he has an audience besides her, he says some things. He says, for example, he says these words to her. He says to her, after the have their great fight when they first meet, which is one of the most delightful encounters, and I have to say this, I mean, that you have a kind of, as an audience, you have an immediate sense when a couple is a good match. That is not a match like they ought to be together, but like they can both knock the other out at any time. That you like that. You sense immediately when a couple is equals on some level, and in the first meeting of these people, you do feel that. But at the end of it, because all the rules are on his side, he says to her the following. He says, she says, keep you warm. He says, am I not wise? And she says, yes, keep you warm, which in essence means, I hope you're smart enough to keep warm, because, you know, that's, you're so stupid, you probably don't know how to keep warm. And he says this. He says, Mary, so I mean, sweet Catherine, in thy bed. I need to point out that he says Catherine. Nobody's on the stage now but Petruchio and Kate. When he first came in, he did that thing that is a real power play. He says, good morrow, Kate, for that's your name, I hear. And she says, well, have you heard? But something hard of hearing. They call me Catherine that do speak to talk of me. And he says, you lie. And by the way, you lie is the most insulting thing you could say to anybody in the period. And just you lie. In faith, for you are called plain Kate and Bonnie Kate and sometimes Kate the Cursed. But Kate, the prettiest Kate in Christendom, Kate of Kate Hall, my super dainty Kate, for dainties are all Kates. And therefore, Kate, take this of me, Kate of my consolation, hearing thy mildness praised in every town, that's a lie. Thy virtue spoke of, that's a lie. And thy beauty sounded, that's a lie. You yet not so deeply as to thee belongs, that's an interesting interruption. Myself am moved to woo thee for my wife. Okay, that's how he starts. Denying her name and what she wants to be called, which is a real ugly power play. I might also say that psychologically, what's your name?
Tish.
If you call somebody by their name, if you say their name again, if I say Tish, if I say this talk Tish, and I keep speaking of you Tish, and I say to you Tish, I'm really glad you're here tonight Tish, and I keep saying your name, on some psychological level, something in your solar plexus keeps getting not, because your name, like Ralph, is not very usual. And when you keep hearing it all the time, you respond to it as you might imagine you would, since the very first thing you ever heard was your parents looking over your crib saying, hey, Tish, 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 say, you know, say mama, say da, da, whatever they want. Tish, Tish, Tish. What do they call it when, ring a bell? It's called a Pavlovian response. Yeah, so it's your first Pavlovian response. Tish, right? Kate, 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 Kate. But at the end he says, now, Mary, so I mean sweet Catherine, So whatever he was doing and whatever the fight was, he's now gone to Catherine in thy bed. So I mean, so I'm going to keep me warm in thy bed. So, yes. And therefore, setting all this chat aside, so this fight that you're going to see, which is mammoth and takes 4 or 5 pages in the text, he calls a chat. All the fighting was chat. Setting all this chat aside, thus in plain terms, your father hath consented that you shall be my wife. That is true. Your dowry agreed on. That is true. And will you? Kneel you. I will marry you. And there's nothing you can do about it. And that is true too. I mean, given the rules of the game. It's awful. I don't like the rules. But he's not lying to her. Nor is he saying anything that's anything but true. Now, Kate, I am a husband for your turn. That's kind of interesting. He's back to Kate. I am a husband for your turn. For by this light whereby I see thy beauty. Thy beauty, this is another interrupter that's kind of interesting, that doth make me like thee well, thou must be married to no man but me. Now I want to show you something. I want to show you something. I want to show you, if I can get it, let's see. It's not in here. I don't have an image here for you. Many, many paperback editions show him with a whip or something like that. What I want to show you is truly interesting to me. After saying that, all of which I can even with 3 daughters, I can deal with. Because that all seems like, okay, here's the situation, lady. I've never met you before. I've never met before. I heard you were rich. I know your father wants to get you married off. I've agreed to do that. This was an arranged marriage. These are the deal. None of that bothers me because that's the part that bothers me comes next. For I am he born to tame you, Kate, and bring you from a wild Kate to a Kate conformable as other household Kates. I don't like that. If you have daughters, you don't like that. I don't like that. Enter Baptista, Gremio, and Trinio. Can you guys see where it says the text just breaks and you see the little enter? See that there? Now, tonight, I want you all to watch for this. Part of what I did to try to prepare myself to teach this was to look very closely at what happens in the folio. You know, because editors, over the centuries, 4 centuries, have been changed. Editors don't change the words too terribly much. They try to be careful. They really care. But they will get a sort of superiority complex about the stage direction. The next words are, here comes your father. Never make denial. After the ugly 3 lines. 3 ugly lines. And I think we'd all agree. This is what's really interesting to me. You look in the folio, and that stage direction comes after thou must be married to no man but me, which is the end of the here's the situation speech, before the taming speech. They walk in there. Now, what's the difference? Who cares? Why am I, here you are, poor strangers, being forced to think about these stage directions in the folio? Well, it's a huge deal. Because the editor obviously saw, here comes your father, thought that Shakespeare had made a mistake, moved the thing down. But what does that do? That means, alone on stage, he has said to her, I am he born to tame thee, Kate. Alone to her. In the way Shakespeare writes it, they've come onto the stage just when he finishes, this is the way it is. So when he says, I am he born to tame you, Kate, he may not be saying it for her. He may be saying it for them. You see the difference? It's a huge difference. Terrifically big difference. If I was sure, that Shakespeare was wrong, that the folio text, folio stage entrance, I don't think I'd want us doing this play. Because we would, in fact, have a wife tamer on our hands, right? In a sort of There'd be something different. It's such a big deal. But if, in fact, he's playing this part for them, something else is going on. That's the kind of thing we're really interested in here, in doing. And it's the kind of thing, as I say, it's hard to say. It's hard to defend most of the time. It's hard to defend. I have to tell you that as the years have gone by, I told you this is an important play to me. So I got this woman in the class to come down and do the very unpleasant Pauline ending three different ways. I got one of my male students to just sit there while she gave the speech, the one, "Fie, fie, unknit thy threatening, unkind brow, and dart not scornful glances from thy eyes." She's telling this to the other women. "To wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor, it blots thy beauty as frost do bite the meads, confounds thy name, and as whirlwinds shake fair buds, and in no sense is meet or amiable. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty, and while it is so, none so dry or thirsty will deign to sip or touch one drop of it. Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper," and the rest of this really Pauline speech. Okay? I said to her, "Do it three ways." Y'all are listening to a historic moment, because this is the first thing I ever directed. First Shakespeare I ever directed was telling Elena Remsen, "Do it three ways." And practicing it in my office with, you know, I just had her do. And one of them, she means it completely, totally means it. And in the second one, she totally doesn't mean it. It's all a lie, which is what usually people do with this. And in the third one, only thing we know is that she loves him and that they're going to win a lot of money if she gets the speech right. That's all we know, is that that there's a game going on between the two of them, and that nobody, and you can't know whether she means it or doesn't mean it, doesn't matter. It's not really pertinent, because what it's about is they're getting this money together and their relationship is their own private business and we don't know what it is. So, we did it in class, and the students really loved it, and Elena really enjoyed it. So I got this idea. I thought, you know what, I'd like to put on this play and use these thoughts, you know, and see if we couldn't put on a play in which Petruchio is really trying to do her a favor by teaching her that the one thing you can do in this sexist, sexist, awful world, other than change the world entirely, which I don't think Shakespeare ever believes quite happens, is to enjoy the world through performance. And if the rest of the world is crazy, you can be crazier. And you can say what you want. You can say the sun is the moon. And you know what? It won't make a bit of difference. The sun will keep shining. And you can talk all you want about it being the moon. And that's up to you. You can say the opposite. It's up to you. Your words are yours. Put on a play. Put on a play. Whenever you need to. No? That's, you know, whistle a happy tune. And then, in fact, that's what he was saying. I wanted to try that. And when I was rushing down here with the wrong play, ready to give you a lecture on the other play, I grabbed this off my shelf at Rose. And it turns out it's the very text I used, and I decided to put on this play, and I did. It's the first thing I ever directed. And it's my text that I used for that play. I couldn't believe it. It's all the notes in here. So I've got a little archival treasure for myself here. And you can see how old it is because this book costs 95 cents. So see, it says 95 cents. So anyhow.
So when you directed, you had the three come out?
No. When I directed it, I chose the last one. I chose not knowing, because everybody does I'm just lying here, girls. I don't really care. I don't believe any of this. And what I don't like about that is, it means that nothing's happened between them at all. It means that there's going to be a marriage, but that marriage is going to be, she's going to be impossible. And the other one is just incredibly ugly. When she says, when she really means it, "I'll put my hand beneath your foot," and, you know, all that stuff. And I've seen that production, by the way. I saw RFC did that production. And it's so chilling. It just isn't a comedy anymore. You know, I did the other. And I made a lot of points that I had learned from studying the folio.
What are we doing tonight?
It's not my production. It's Jim Warren's production. But Jim was my student, and Jim likes this idea. And we've done this show a lot. Why have we done this show so much? It sells. It's the craziest thing. It sells. Doesn't seem, huh?
Are you going to tell us which speech we're going to give?
You'll know. You won't have any trouble knowing. But so what you're going to get tonight is a Petruchio who's always playing is a game. And there are many other things to support this reading. And I apologize, female colleagues listening to this podcast. Because, you know, I'd love to, because I'm going to finish with some of the ugly things in the play. But one of the things that's really interesting to me that you need to notice is the relationship between Petruchio and his servant, Grumio. When they come out, they're going to have a big fight. That's supposed to be his servant. And he's going to say, knock me at this door. And Grumio's going to say, knock you at that door? I'm going to knock you at that door. I know what happens to me if I knock you at that door. So Grumio, like any clown figure, immediately takes the meaning, tries to make a joke with the meaning. All he meant was knock on the door. He should have said knock on the door. But he said, knock me at this door. And so they get in a fight. Really interesting thing is they come to the house of Hortensio. Hortensio comes out and says, my old friend Grumio, my good friend Petruchio, and talks to them both as though they're equal friends. It's very strange, because that's not the relationship between master and servant. So Shakespeare does give us this odd relationship of master and servant, and he gives that to a master who is also the husband in this odd play about the relationship between men and women in marriage. So I will say that too. You should notice that. There are many other things about this play that are interesting to me, but it still is hard for me. And I'm just going to say, to hear that speech and to hear other speeches. And one other speech, I think I have until the big hand is on the 8. There's one other speech that I want to leave you with that is ugly and to me in some ways and many ways. I want to say this. Oh, I know. One other thing I need to say very much. I looked very carefully through the folio for any stage direction that suggests he ever hits not only her, but anyone else. Because most of us think of Petruchio as a whip wielding. Yes, in fact, you can look and find paintings in the 18th century, which is a really misogynist century, paintings of him that way. But that's the painter. You can find paperback covers with him doing that. I mean, you really can. But that's the paperback. That's the publisher trying to sell a book. There's not one time in the folio when he hits anybody. He takes Grumio by the ear. And the stage direction says he takes him by the ear. But if I take you by the ear, right, tell me the difference between that and I'm pulling you back. What is there about taking somebody by the ear that's different than hitting them? Just visually, what's different? What's the effect on you about the relationship between... If I'm having a fight with some guy and instead of really hitting him, I grab him by the ear, you know, and I hold him by the ear, what happens to that, to the weight of that?
It becomes silly
because we think of grabbing kids by the ears. We think, you know, it's a Three Stooges thing, right? It's a kind of Three Stooges moment. Okay, he does do that, and there's text for that. There's another line where he says to one of his servants, take that. But the servant is taking off one of his boots. So he could simply mean take that particular boot. And it, actually the rest of the line is, and mend the taking of the other. So it, you know, could be. But even if it isn't, it's in a scene where he's pretending to be absolutely nuts in front of her. And his servants look to me as though they're really in on it. Like at one point, he calls for his dog. Where's my dog, Troilus? There's no dog, Troilus. He calls for his cousin, Ferdinand. There's no cousin, Ferdinand. He's just making up stuff as he goes along. So we do play all that. And you'll see, and it's actually one of the great scenes you'll ever see just for the choreography. It's just fabulous. You're in for a great treat. Finally, I'm still going to get to that speech and just finish with the ugly speech, but there's one other little moment I want to mention, and it's what the play begins with. The play does not begin with the play. The play begins with something called an induction. It's a very odd thing. There's a character, and it's, by the way, in England. Somehow it's in England, but the story's in Italy. It's in Padua. But the induction is about this guy who's a drunk, and he's being thrown out, and his name is Christopher Sly, and a lord comes by and sees him drunk and says, let's take him home. I got this great idea for a joke. Let's take him home, tell him he's a lord, you know, and put nice clothes on him, and just try to talk him into thinking he's a lord.
It's a kind of odd joke, but that's what he wants to do. So they take him home. And they tell him he's a lord. He's been asleep for 15 years. He's got a wife. You want to meet her? The character says, all he has to do to get all this stuff, the food and the drink and the new clothes and the woman, is say, I am a lord. And he says, I am a lord. You know, and I have been asleep. I'll be darned. Because he gets a lot. I don't know why. So I don't know if he means it or not. Just like I don't know if she means it or not at the end. It's very similar. But they both get the same thing if they say yes. They get fed, clothed, laid. They get, sheltered. All that. They get all that if they just will say some words. And this words, now, then they put the play on for him. And then there is no, he's not in the end of it. He just disappears. I think it's a key to the play, which is, I'll play along. I get a lot if I play along. So I'm just putting that out there. But let's end on this speech. And after the funny scene, you're going to see the really hilarious scene when he brings her home. And I think our production of it is really, really, really good. And it's as good as we've ever done it. Better. This is Act 4, Scene 1. he comes out to the audience and he says, alone. Everybody else has gone in. He says this, thus have I politically begun my reign. Therein, she's gone up to bed. She's expecting him to come up and have her, I guess. Which he doesn't. And 'tis my hope to end successfully. My falcon now is sharp and passing empty. Until she stoops, she must not be full gorged. So he makes the analogy to a falconer and how you train a falcon. Another way I have to man my haggard to make her come and know her keeper's call, that is to watch her. And as we watch those kites that bait and beat and will not be obedient. She ate no meat tonight, nor none shall eat. So I'm not going to feed her. He doesn't eat either, but I'm not going to feed her. Last night she slept not, neither did he. Nor tonight she shall not, neither does he. As with the meat, some undiscovered fault I'll found about the making of the bed, and here I'll fling the pillow, there the bolster, this way the coverlet, another way the sheets. And amid this hurly-burly, I intend that all is done in reverent care of her. Now, I could try to read that as a nice thing, but it's also like I'm just pretending to care about her, so I'm not going to, I think it's ugly. And in conclusion, she shall watch all night, and if she chance to nod, if she starts to fall asleep, I'll rail and brawl, and with the clamor keep her still awake. This is the way to kill a wife with kindness. And thus I'll curb her mad and headstrong humor. And then he's got two more lines, and I'll end with that. And I think it's ugly. And there's no way it's ugly. Not ugly. It's just ugly. Having said that, it seems to me that we could posit that a woman found the original text in which it wasn't a falcon, but an ox or a horse or a mule. And the feminists wanted to make it better and made it a falcon. Because I will say this, there is something quite magical about the relationship of a falcon and a falconer. Because the falcon is the one who can fly. And the falcon can leave any time. It's the falconer who's grounded. And the falcon can do the flying. And in a way, that's sort of... So there is that. But this finish is how... And you'll see this moment. It's an amazing moment. Petruchio will say, he that knows better how to tame a shrew, let him speak. 'Tis pity now to show. That's a really scary and ugly moment to me. A scary and ugly moment. I always feel that someone's going to say, raise their hand in the audience and say, beat the bitch. No, seriously. It's almost an invitation to say, you know, I mean, it's ugly. You know, it's ugly. It's scary. I feel like Shakespeare is on there's something on the brink of it. It's so not like any other relationship between men and women in the comedies. But it's such an unpleasant moment. There are pleasant moments. There are good things. So you decide. I think the play, very wise man Stephen Booth says, you can bend it all you want. It's going to bounce back. You will see us giving Petruchio all his due tonight. I think we're doing more right by Petruchio than is usually done. I also think the play is still about something that makes us most uncomfortable and should. If he is freeing her, he is freeing her to get by in a world that is wrong about the way to treat women. But I always tell my students, don't get cocky. Don't feel it can, you know, we're all that much smarter. I've been watching Mad Men. You know, it doesn't take much. Watch out for your rights, because it can go back any time. It can always go back. You need to be very careful. This play always reminds me of that. And I find it troubling, and I find it great. And I love that one of Shakespeare's early plays, he wrote this about 1593, that one of his early plays already has this complicated issues in it. And a character that some people can see is totally bad, and I can see is quite interesting, and sort of like a lot of other Shakespeare's playmaking characters, like Hamlet and Henry V and lots of other characters, evil ones too, like Iago. In fact, what's interesting is Ben Kearns plays Iago and he plays Petruchio. Both of them make up things. Enjoy yourselves. I think you will. And thank you so much for being here tonight. And I hope you like the show. I think you'll find the talent extraordinary. I think you're in for a real surprise. Like this room. Take care.
Dr. Ralph Allen Cohen, recorded before a live audience at the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia, on September 22, 2010. We hope you have enjoyed this edition of Dr. Ralph Presents. You can download future editions of Dr. Ralph for free at AmericanShakespeareCenter.blogspot.com or subscribe to all of the ASC's podcasts through the iTunes Music Store podcast directory or through any number of other podcast listing sites. The Taming of the Shrew will be appearing as part of the 2010 fall season at the Blackfriars Playhouse in repertory with William Shakespeare's Henry IV Part II and Othello, along with John O'Keefe's Wild Oats and Thomas Haywood's Fair Maid of the West through November 28th. Tickets for all five fall season productions are available by calling the American Shakespeare Center box office toll-free at 1-877-MUCH-ADO or by going online at AmericanShakespeareCenter.com. I'm Bill Gordon. Special thanks to recording engineer Sam Kugler. Thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the Blackfriars Playhouse.